I have subscribed to a magazine called World Magazine. It's essentially an evangelical news magazine. It's pretty good, actually. It's not so much got a theological bent to it as much as it just tries to give perspective on Christianity and world events. A recent headline in that magazine said the following: "Is the world falling apart?" The subtitle was, "It often looks that way. But from church basements in Ukraine, to living rooms in Iraq, to fellowship halls in Israel, a redemptive center holds." Can we add to that list to small church buildings in Chatham, New Jersey? What holds our redemptive center together? Well, I believe our redemptive center is held together by our common belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ and by the promises that Jesus himself made, that where two or three are gathered together, there I am in the midst of them. Size means nothing in terms of that. Size is nice. Size is encouraging. But the fact is, we have to believe that our redemptive center is still holding as well. Paul tells the Philippians in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15 that you shine as lights in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. So was it really all that different from then to now? I doubt it. I think they probably looked around at the world and said to themselves, is the world falling apart? Could have felt that way. It does feel that way at times, doesn't it? Looking at the news, you know, judging from what's going on, it just seems like the world is falling apart. Last week, we talked about some things that I think we would like to see that make our church receptive and appealing to others. There's a lot of what the apostle says in Philippians, I think, that really should do that. And maybe it's less about making our whole community appealing and receptive to others, but maybe it's about making ourselves appealing, receptive, and open to other people. There are a few other things that the apostle says here to them, I think, to do that. In chapter 4, Paul mentions quite a few neat things, I think, that I'm not going to spend a lot of time on today, but I think maybe things for your own reflection. One is, he wants them to possess the peace that passes understanding. Yeah, and in a world that's falling apart, I'd like to have that. Maybe in a world that's falling apart, maybe as people look at you and say, how come you're so at peace? Might be an opportunity to talk about your faith. He further on tells them in chapter 4 and verse 8, happens to be Janet's favorite verse of the New Testament, that they should focus their lives on things that are good and noble and right. And Paul just piles on all these positive words, and they're the kind of things that we should be thinking about. He says, think about these things. Focus your mind on those things. You want to get your mind off of the fact that the world's falling apart? Not a bad thing to just focus on what you can do that are good. And he also tells them to be content in whatever the circumstances. Probably that's one that would address the whole issue was quite well. But I think all of these things are kind of appealing traits to a confused, disruptive world. However, I do think there's one trait that I want to spend my time on today that kind of stands out, and that was, as Steve said, the one short verse before our lesson today, and that is, let your gentleness be evident to all. Chapter 4 and verse 5. And I'd like to make two points about that today. And maybe I can give you some way of kind of keeping it in your minds. There's sort of images and metaphors that sometimes I like to use to kind of help you remember these things. Sometimes what I do when I do like a two-point sermon, we'll look at that as maybe the two sides of a coin. You know, you got heads and you got tails. They're different, but they're still one coin. They still kind of fit together. My 2 points today are not two separate sides, not a heads and a tails, but more like 2 points connected by a straight line, okay? They're points that are very much in parallel with each other. And I know geometrically a straight line is kind of boring, okay? But maybe if you could see it, two pictures connected by a straight line, two pictures of the same thing, but maybe you know, painted with colors and depth and so forth. And the ideas have some real foundation for what we are. Or, let me give you one other one. It's like stars in a constellation, okay? We already talked about peace that passes understanding, contentment, thinking about good things, thinking about gentleness, and maybe put them in a constellation, all connected. But it's like one constellation that, as Paul says, shines like lights in a dark world. Maybe that's the best metaphor to think about these two points that I want to make today. The first point is one about Jesus Christ himself. And if you will turn to the book of Matthew, we'll begin there by thinking about the fact that Jesus says of himself, "I am meek and gentle in heart. Come to me and you'll have rest for your souls." Matthew 11, chapter 29 and 30. "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Gentle and lowly in heart. There's some interesting play on the words here that occur in the Greek language. I'll try to kind of ferret some of it out as we go through. But if you look at Jesus' statement, "I am meek and lowly in heart," or "gentle and humble in heart," there's ever a number of ways that these are translated in your New Testaments. Essentially, I think he's equating the two ideas. Meek and humble, gentle and lowly, they all kind of fit the same idea. Gentleness is somewhat inherent in the word meek. And if you remember back in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 5, Jesus says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." Paul will say something similar in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1 when he's appealing to the Corinthians by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. Very interesting way to appeal to them. But think about the idea of meekness. We usually translate it as the word humble. Okay? And a person who's humble is perhaps, in my way of thinking, somewhat approachable. Comforting, perhaps. I can get comfortable with a person because maybe they're a kind of a good listener. Some people just seem to have this intuitive nature about them that it makes them easy for people to talk to them. And they just listen to what you have to say. Rather than trying to talk themselves, they're willing to hear what you have to say. They're interested in you, not just interested in getting their opinion out. I kind of think of some of that when I think of the word humble. They're not driven and ambitious. They're not kind of edgy or arrogant. They're just calm and engaging. Okay? You can talk to them. There's probably more, but that's what I think of when I think of what humility does for us and how it opens our lives up to other people. I tend to think that's what Jesus was. And I think that partly not just because of what he says here, but what he's going to say later on, or what Matthew will say about him in the next chapter. But he does tell us here, does he not, that his yoke is easy and his burden is light. Some people, you can just unburden yourself to them. Now, don't do it to everybody, or don't always do it to the same person, because they're going to feel like they get burdened way too much. But it certainly is in contrast here to the teachers of the law who made the burdens on people so heavy they couldn't carry them. Here's what one commentator said about this passage. "A relationship with Jesus provides a deep sense of ultimate well-being." Maybe that's kind of a little bit more of a fancy way of saying Jesus just made people comfortable in his presence. And he wanted that. Now over in Matthew chapter 12, passage that was read this morning, verses 15 through 21, Matthew brings this out even more, and he attaches it to some real theological significance in terms of who the Messiah is and how he's going to approach his ministry. He says, "Behold my servant." Now, you may or may not be aware, but in the book of Isaiah, there are three passages in the book of Isaiah that are often known as the servant songs. Okay? You know the third one, and that's Isaiah 53. That's the one that we probably know of most. This one here is from Isaiah 42, and it's the first of the three. Behold my servant. Who is this servant going to be? He doesn't tell us who he is, but he describes him. So that when he comes, perhaps he can be recognized. And it's interesting what Matthew does with this here. As we've gone through the Gospels, it's very noticeable that more often than not, when Jesus heals people, he says, don't go tell anybody. And of course, you know what's going to happen. You know, how can you be quiet when somebody does something like heal you of your blindness or, you know, heal you of your paralysis or heal you of anything? How can you be quiet? And a lot of times we tend to think, and I think there's some truth to this, it's sort of part of the truth here, Jesus wants to be able to enter towns quietly. Well, the reason Jesus wants to enter towns quietly, Matthew seems to see, is because it was a fulfillment of one of the servant prophecies, one of these servant songs. Behold my servant. And think about what he says about him here. Number one, he says, he will not quarrel or cry aloud. He's not going to go in and make a big fuss with everybody. He's not going to just get in arguments purposefully. He's not going to get in debates purposefully. Now, he will talk to people, and apparently people listen to his teaching, and he says some very, very profound and powerful and challenging things. There's no question about it. But his point is not necessarily to provoke as much as it is to reveal. To reveal something about the truth of God. He says, no one will hear his voice in the streets. Which is kind of interesting because he ends up having to go out into wilderness places where people can come to him because there's so many people want to see him. What Jesus seems to prefer to do is to go into a town, go into the synagogues. He does that more often than not, at least early on in his ministry, and just teach and heal. And perhaps he likes to even go into people's homes. We see him in people's homes regularly. I think what apparently he likes to do is just go in and talk to people across the table, across the kitchen table. Is that the way to see this? But he prefers to do it where he can just engage them in conversation. He's meek and he's gentle. You can talk to him. And he wants to talk to you. No quarreling or crying aloud. No one will hear his voice in the streets. I've been behind the pulpit for 30 plus years now. And I've engaged in conversation with a lot of other preachers. And I see their different styles. And, you know, to listen to some preachers, you'd think that the only way they think people will listen is to shout and get angry. Kind of doesn't seem to me to be the way Jesus approaches it here. Now, I'm all for pointing out sins, but just bear with me and think about the nature of Christ here and how he's approaching this. His real work, it seems to me, involved quiet, gentle conversation. Now, the content of it was extremely powerful and profound. And it did challenge people. And the things he did challenged those who felt threatened. But it was, to me, it seems to me, gentle, quiet conversation. Do zeal and passion for the gospel demand a forceful approach? I don't know. It just seems to me we have to recognize what Jesus was here. He says, he won't damage a bruised reed or a smoldering wick. Rather than crush or humble others, Jesus prefers an approach that fans small fires into flames. Yeah, if you've ever been out in the wilderness, in fact, I went camping with my son Jeremy before his wedding. We went up, we were like 11,000 feet up. And it was cold, you know. But one of the things you got to do is build a fire. And you start the fire by just a few, little spark or whatever you use to it, but you kind of do it gently to get this, you blow on it gently and get a few embers going. And then you build slowly on that, you know. But it takes a finesse approach to get that fire going. Does it not seem to you that's what Isaiah is saying about the Messiah here, the servant? He will not damage a bruised reed or a smoldering wick. He had to work with people who didn't understand that sometimes. Very interesting. James and John. Do you know Do you know what James and John's nickname was by Jesus? They were the sons of thunder. Now think about what that might mean. Sons of thunder. You ever hear, I've heard preachers say to other preachers in discussion, "Now don't steal my thunder here." You know? Don't steal my thunder. You know, we think that we have to do it loud, I guess. I'm not sure. Mark Twain was I think, one who pointed out, it's not thunder that does the work, it's the lightning. Thunder's just the sound. Lightning's what really does the light. It makes everything, you able to see everything. That's the power. But that's what he called James and John. And in Luke chapter 9, verses 51 through 56, it becomes fairly clear they were prone to angry outbursts. Fiery outbursts, perhaps. Because they wanted to call down fire and destroy a Samaritan village. They wanted to be Elijah. Jesus says, no, that's not what we're about here. So he turns and rebukes them. They were also very ambitious. In Mark chapter 10, 35 through 39, it's those two guys that come to Jesus and say, "Hey, we want to be the big shots." Jesus says, no, that's not even for me to decide. Jesus was gentle and humble in spirit. He won't snuff out a burning wick. He won't crawl or cry aloud in the streets. He just goes about talking to people, admittedly challenging them. His ways were not the ways of most individuals, but he did it in a way that hopefully opened their hearts up. We turn now to what the Apostle Paul says to the church in Philippi. And hence the single verse I wanted to focus on today, where the Apostle Paul says, "Let your gentleness be known to everyone." Now, my word there is the word reasonableness. That's how mine is translated. And it's a very interesting word because it's a very, very difficult word to translate from the Greek into the English. And I don't like to usually spend a lot of time explaining words, but I think this one's important for us to do that because it really focuses in on the idea. Some even suggest the word here, rather than either reasonableness or gentleness. I'm not sure if anybody else's translation has something different. But the word can be also translated as, you ready for this? Magnanimity. What is a person who is magnanimous? A magnanimous person possesses the quality of being generous, especially in their judgment of others. They would rather give somebody else a break. They would rather look at the good side of what they did. They're magnanimous in that. They're not just... Aristotle contrasts this word, one of the other Greek writers, he contrasts this word here with the idea of strict justice. So a person who's magnanimous doesn't necessarily judge others by strict justice or strict law. All right? And here's how one commentator described it. It is, I quote, "that considerate courtesy and respect to the integrity of others, which prompts a person not to be forever standing on his rights." Now, I don't know if that's too much of a mouthful, but in other words, a person who is not harsh in their judgment of others. That's magnanimous. That's reasonableness. That's gentleness. That's the word that the Apostle Paul uses here. Doesn't use that word very, doesn't occur very much in the New Testament. Some even translate the word sweet reasonableness. The word seems to be associated with the word for reason in the Greek language. But listen, and sometimes words, you can tell what the word means by the context. Okay? Whenever I have had the opportunity to kind of tutor kids with some English, one of the things I say is, think about the context to understand the meaning of the word. Now, here's this particular word keeps company with the following words. See if it doesn't fit. Peaceable, good, pure, peace-loving, open to reason, and rich in mercy. Now, I won't say those are all exact definitions of the word that the apostle uses here, but those are the words that you find it in context with, okay? Now, this is not the word Jesus uses of himself in Matthew 11. However, Paul does use this word in the context of who Jesus is in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1. I'd like you to turn to that. It's only one verse, but I'd like you to turn to that one. Because I want you to see here the connection between this. Remember the straight line between the idea of what Paul says here about gentleness and who Jesus is in Matthew 11 and 12? Here's the connection. I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. The word meekness is the one that occurs in Matthew 11. The word gentleness is the one that occurs in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 5. So there's really a straight line between Jesus meek and gentle, Jesus not quarreling or crying out, and Paul saying in Philippians 4 and verse 5, I appeal to you, or, you know, let your gentleness, reasonableness, whatever the word is, magnanimity, be apparent to everyone. People ought to see it. People ought to see just what it is. And it's interesting, his appeal here, he's appealing to people that they might stop doing certain things. All right? Corinth was a, I want to say it was a horrendous church. It was disruptive in many ways. Now, Paul appeals to them. How? Appeals to them, just, guys, I appeal to you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I who am humble when face to face, but bold toward you when I'm away. That's what they kind of said about him. But he says, look, I'm just trying to appeal to you the way Christ would appeal to you. And I think this is exactly what he wants the Philippians to exhibit. How will it be evident to everyone? And maybe that's the question we have to kind of ask of ourselves. Well, I can give you several things that I know that Paul kind of applies the same idea. He tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, that when you teach somebody and they disagree with you, correct them with gentleness. Peter, when he's talking to the wives in his group, in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 4, when they're trying to appeal to their husbands, he says, do that with a gentle and quiet spirit. That is so much valued by God himself. He tells the fathers in numerous places in Ephesians and Colossians not to provoke their children or be harsh with their wives. Colossians 3 and verse 9. But I think some of the words out of the book of Proverbs may perhaps give us the idea in how we are to speak. Because our gentleness can be seen perhaps most in the way we speak and approach others. You know, you think about Jesus in that quiet approach, just going around talking to people, going around ministering to their needs. Proverbs 15 verse 1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. In chapter 15 and verse 4, a gentle tongue is a tree of life. Well, that's kind of a nice image, isn't it? A gentle tongue is a tree of life. Think about the bearing of fruit, the shade that a good tree can give to you, the fact that it can be used to build things. A gentle tongue is a tree of life. And then there's Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 15. With patience, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will break a bone. Think about that image. A soft tongue will break a bone. I know it's not the word gentle, but it sure sounds like it, doesn't it? But what can a soft tongue do? Soft tongue, break a bone? Does that have to do with the power of a soft and gentle tongue? Now, we're going to use the right words with that soft and gentle approach because the content of the words is very important. But you see, shouting, I guess, and getting loud, and I know I'm probably prone to this as anybody because, you sort of get this zeal going. You get your juices flowing, and you feel like you want to make your point, you know. And the louder you shout it, you think the more you've made your point. It doesn't seem to be what Jesus and what Paul are trying to say to us. Let me conclude by making the following statement, and I think this maybe sums up what I'm trying to say. You can be committed, zealous, and passionate about your faith without being a son of thunder. You think that's what Paul is trying to say? I kind of think that's a summation of what he's saying when he says, "Let your gentleness be evident to all." And again, the direct line between Jesus, humble and gentle, and "let your gentleness be evident to all" seems to me to be a pretty good straight line, a pretty good, you know, one way to get from point A to point B very quickly. The gentle persuasion of Christ, I think, is one of those things that will help us hold our redemptive center. Makes us approachable to each other. It makes us, I think, approachable to others. And maybe more importantly, it reflects the character of Jesus Christ himself. And so I would just simply encourage us today to make every effort to imitate Jesus' spirit of gentleness in your life this week.